B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Monday, March 6, 2017. And like many people, I find myself stunned by the sequence of events that's unraveling on a daily basis. And will somebody take Trump's Twitter account and shut it down permanently, please? I mean, maybe Arnold could do it for us. So it was a wild weekend. We were just settling in behind the news, of course, of Jeff Sessions. Did he perjure himself? Will he pay a price? And he's agreed to revise and amend his testimony to the Senate Judiciary Committee here on Monday. Haven't seen any reports on that so far. Then Saturday morning, the Trumpster, before he went out to play golf, fired off a round of tweets attacking Barack Obama and suggesting that Obama had personally ordered wiretaps of Trump Tower during the campaign and perhaps post-election. Trump offered not a scintilla of evidence, simply that he had read reports. And were those intelligence briefings that are so confidential and classified that you and I would never know about them? Nah. It was alt-right speculation, starting on the radio show of knuckle-dragging Neanderthal Mark Levin. His show broadcasts on a station here in San Francisco, so I hear him ranting and raving occasionally. He's a very annoying guy. And his claim to connecting to conservatism is some kind of a minor job in the Reagan administration way back in the glory days of the Republican conservatives. So Mark Levin speculates that the Obama administration wiretapped the Trump team. The language used, Obama had used the instrumentalities of the federal government to wiretap the Republican seeking to succeed him. So Mark Levin rants and raves about this. Next day, Breitbart News covers the speculation of Mark Levin. And this becomes multiple reports, according to the spin doctors in the White House, including Sarah Huckabee. And so now this takes on some weight and momentum, and the Donald then starts his Twitter attacks on Obama. And this is, uncharted territory. We have never seen this occur. And Trump, of course, has attacked Obama on the birther issue. He also claimed that, there are other conspiracies, such as they're called, that he has embraced over the years. And I, of course, bristle at the term conspiracy because it's often used to marginalize and malign people who have honest questions and honorable intentions. And I'm not suggesting that Trump has either of those going in his favor. So we know. Well, let me say this. We don't know much. And I was about to say we know that there are reports in the New York Times saying that the government has information, intercepts, wiretaps, or metadata, showing frequent contacts between members of the Trump campaign and, we're told, Russian intelligence. So based on that, Trump has a right to feel a little paranoid and like he was being monitored and surveilled. But the paranoia is that he thinks that he's the only one. And apparently his anger was out of control, compounded by being pissed off at Jeff Sessions for recusing himself from any investigations into the Russia questions. And then just the whipped cream and cherry on top of his Twitter activity on Saturday morning, he took another swipe at Arnold Schwarzenegger, saying that he's being fired from The Apprentice due to bad ratings, and Schwarzenegger has apparently quit. I don't really care. But it shows the meandering mind, the limited attention span, and the bizarre priorities of the guy who is playing president these days. And so one of the bottom lines here is that Trump is in a fix, and he could fix it. We'll get to that in a moment. But we also saw yesterday the proven perjurer James Clapper, who kept his job for 3 years after lying under oath before a Senate committee. Well, he was on Meet the Press. I saw it for myself. I made an exception. I rarely watch the Sunday morning shows, but it was raining, and I stayed in bed and turned on the TV. And what Clapper said was, nope. There was no order to wiretap the Trump campaign, or Trump Tower in particular. That was followed by the FBI director, who's got credibility issues himself, James Comey. For some reason, he reached out to the Justice Department and said, you guys need to correct this. Now, Comey is capable of issuing a statement on his own. He's got his own press team at the FBI. And while he nominally is on the organizational chart under the Justice Department, it's kind of silly for him to try to get them to carry water for him. Then we get Huckabee Sanders on another Sunday morning TV show. And she has to step very carefully here. I think he firmly believes that this is a storyline that has been reported pretty widely by quite a few outlets. Now, what I told you is that the mainstream media has reported on the speculation that was launched by Mark Levin and Breitbart because the president jumped on it. Otherwise, they wouldn't have bothered. And when I hear Comey and Clapper make these kinds of comments, I'm reminded of what Obama said at his news conference in late December. It's like, who are you going to believe, the Russians or our intelligence community? And that presents a very difficult choice to a guy like me. I don't really want to prefer what the Russians have to say, but I can't believe my own intelligence community. Statement from the White House today from Sean Boy Spicer. Reports concerning potentially politically motivated investigations immediately ahead of the 2016 election are very troubling. President Donald J. Trump is requesting that as part of their investigation into Russian activity, congressional intelligence committees exercise their oversight authority to determine whether executive branch investigative powers were abused in 2016. And here's the real capper. Neither the White House nor the president will comment further until such oversight is conducted. So, Trump lit the fuse. The House is burning. But he will have no further comment until it is completely reduced to ashes. I mean, it's just so bizarre. And here's the critical bottom line point. And it's made by two people today. John Schwartz, writing at The Intercept, notes that presidents have the power to declassify anything at any time. Trump could immediately make public any government records of the surveillance that he has alleged. But he didn't provide any evidence. There's none forthcoming. He's promising to keep quiet. Now, I'd love to see that. I'd love to experience that. And one of the murky things here that we're still wrestling with is an allegation that was leveled on Friday and has since been walked back by James Clapper, again, another dubious source. And that is, did the Obama administration or any of the tentacles of the intelligence community go to the super secret FISA court and ask for a wiretap order on anything related to Trump? Well, you may recall there was news of an investigation about contacts between a Trump server and a server of a Russian bank. And according to The Intercept, the Justice Department in June asked the FISA court for a warrant to intercept electronic communications by two Russian banks. And this is what's really shocking. According to the BBC, the FISA court turned the application down. Now, we know that in the history of the FISA court, very few of the orders requested have been modified or rejected in any way. It's an infinitesimal number. All right, so the application was turned down. Justice Department asked again in July with a more narrowly drawn request. Turned down again. Really? This is stunning. Justice then made a third request for a warrant on October 15th, which was granted. Now, that's one account. That's from The Intercept. But subsequently, we've been told that, no, there was no FISA court activity whatsoever related to Trump. Now, I don't know what to believe there. But I will say this. I see a lot of corporate media coverage that suggests that without a FISA warrant, that intercepts, wiretaps could not be achieved. And that is bullshit. I've put in a call to my source, Russell Tice, used to work at the NSA and in military intelligence, a stand-up guy. He's the one who revealed over 3 years ago that he saw when he worked at the NSA the orders to wiretap members of the Supreme Court, a freshman senator named Barack Obama, members of the Senate Intelligence Committee. And so apparently Trump wasn't paying attention. Because I thundered from this post here behind this microphone day after day about the violation of the Fourth Amendment rights of Americans, the way that our intelligence community, if they're not legally permitted to wiretap somebody in the United States, they get the Australians, the Canadians, the British, or the New Zealanders to do it. And there are back channels that they swap that kind of stuff on a regular basis. This was all tolerated by Obama, if not really part of policy. So I believe that it's possible. If the New York Times reporting is correct that there were frequent contacts, that means there is some sort of record of that. It's either the metadata of the numbers dialed and the duration of the calls and the parties who were connected, or it's actual transcripts of the intercepted, wiretapped communication. But it didn't necessarily have to go through the FISA court. It was not necessarily ordered directly by Obama. And so, once again, I'm in this awkward position of saying that Trump may have a point. He mangles it and mismanages it and doesn't present it in any way that can really advance his cause. But I remain suspicious because we still have zero evidence of almost all the claims that have been made. And Robert Perry sums it up again in another powerful essay published yesterday at consortiumnews.com. And he talks about official Washington's Russia hysteria has reached such proportions that New York Times columnist Tom Friedman has even compared the alleged Russian hacking of Democratic emails to Pearl Harbor and 9/11, two incidents that led the United States into violent warfare. And Friedman was there on Meet the Press yesterday, and he offered half of the history. He said Putin wants to fracture NATO, without ever mentioning that the U.S. tried to fracture Russia using NATO and that Ukraine was the ground for that conflict. And the U.S. supported the coup that took Yanukovych out because he was too pro-Moscow. Back to Bob Perry here, he says, what really goes to the very core of our democracy is the failure to deal with this issue with the sobriety and seriousness that should accompany a question of war or peace. Before this madness goes any further, Perry says, doesn't anyone think that the U.S. intelligence community should lay its cards on the table regarding exactly what the evidence is that Russian intelligence purloined Democratic emails and then slipped them to WikiLeaks for publication? Obama's intelligence officials apparently went to great lengths to spread these allegations around, but they never told the American people what the evidence is. The two official reports dealing with the issue were laughably short on anything approaching evidence. I fully agree with what Perry's saying here. And that the more likely explanation is that the DNC server and the John Podesta emails were hacked, were leaked, by two different American insiders. Now, Perry notes, and I agree, that that may be false. But it seems that Obama's intelligence officials apparently don't know how WikiLeaks got those emails, and that this entire scandal may rest upon a foundation of sand. And Perry goes on to note that there's this whole effort to discredit the content of the emails, both from the DNC and from Podesta, that were released. And he said, I found this more appropriate, far more appropriate for an American political debate than the scurrilous rumors that the Clinton campaign was circulating about Trump getting urinated on by Russian prostitutes, claims for which no evidence has been presented. So we have a lack of evidence on almost every angle of this story. And the bottom line is that because he has been installed as president of the United States, Donald Trump could order this cleared up with one of those royal decrees. And he issued a cleaned-up royal decree, the travel ban, the Muslim ban. 7 countries reduced to 6. Iraq gets a pass. Lots of loopholes in here. They clearly wrote this new executive order, which rescinds the previous one from the end of January. And it's clear that they coordinated with the departments that were involved, like the State Department and the Justice Department. They were out of the loop when Steve Bannon issued the first decree. And in fact, Trump did not announce that he had signed this new executive order himself. He had Rexon Tillerson and Jeffrey Beauregard Sessions front this for the administration. There are some differences. This is a much more carefully crafted legal document. The thing that Steve Bannon and that other Steve, what's his name, Miller, wrote back at the end of January was much more of a press release and a manifesto. But this one, I am afraid to say, is much more likely to pass muster in the courts, because the president has been given in the Constitution and by Congress the authority to ban people from certain countries from entering the United States. And I think that this is ill-conceived, it's irrational, but it may pass legal muster. Now, I am including a link to the entire executive order in the show file for today's podcast. I've read every word of it, and as I said, it is a much cleaner legal document. I got stuck on this one paragraph about Libya. Libya is an active combat zone with hostilities between internationally recognized government and its rivals. In many parts of the country, security and law enforcement functions are provided by armed militias. Violent extremist groups, including the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, have exploited these conditions to expand their presence in the country. Who's responsible for that? Who took out the strongman Gaddafi and left a failed state there? But this is supposed to breathe life into the threats that we're all supposed to be cowering under. And they offer this as a background. Recent history shows that some of those who've entered the United States through our immigration system have proved to be threats to our national security. It falsely states here, since 2001, hundreds of persons born abroad have been convicted of terrorism-related crimes in the United States. They offer 2 examples, one from, I think, they don't specify this, but I think it's from the Bowling Green Massacre. In October 2014, a native of Somalia who'd been brought to the United States as a child refugee. Oh, wait a minute. That's the next story I want to tell you. But the first example they use, January 2013, 2 Iraqi nationals admitted to the United States as refugees in 2009 were sentenced to 40 years and to life in prison, respectively, for multiple terrorism-related offenses. I think that's the Bowling Green case, and in fact, the crimes that they either pled to or were convicted of are barely related to terrorism. The other case they cite was the guy from Portland, Oregon, who came to the United States as a child refugee, was a naturalized U.S. citizen, and much later was framed by the FBI for this plot to detonate a bomb at a crowded Christmas tree lighting ceremony in Portland, Oregon, 2 or 3 years ago. So they're really stretching the truth to create the appearance of evidence to rationally support the order of the president. So he says, in order to avoid spending additional time pursuing litigation, I am revoking Executive Order 13,769 and replacing it with this one. And as I said, it does have a lot of loopholes. If you already have a visa, you're allowed in. If you had a visa on January 27th, you may enter the country. If you're a lawful permanent resident, those green card holders who were denied entry, And it goes through quite a few other examples, including asylum and waivers that can be arbitrarily issued by either the commissioner, U.S. Customs and Border Protection, or a person delegated by the commissioner. So it doesn't even rise to a cabinet level to issue waivers. And there are many other exceptions and exclusions that are written into this agreement, including a withdrawal of the special treatment for minority religious groups that was seen to favor Christians over Muslims, and add a religious test to the order. So, again, as I review this, and I'm not an attorney, I believe that this is much more likely to be approved by the courts. And they even delayed implementation of it for 10 days so that people who, you know, might be planning to travel to the United States can adjust those plans based on this new order. So we'll see. I'm sure that there will be immediate court filings, even today, to try to suspend the implementation of the latest Donald royal decree. But we'll have to see what kind of judges get that and how they rule. I've linked in the show file for today's podcast to a data-rich presentation in today's New York Times, and I'm just going to cite two elements of it. It's lengthy and detailed, and it really shows the reality of immigration patterns toward the United States today. And for example, there are far more people who are currently in this country illegally because they overstayed a visa, most likely a tourist visa or a student visa, as compared to those who crossed over the Mexican border. There is a dramatic difference. Far fewer people are coming in over the southern border. Each year from 2007 to 2014, more people joined the ranks of the illegal by remaining in the U.S. after their temporary visitor permits expired than by coming across the Mexican border. Of course, that's why we need to build the wall, right? To contain all those people who came in through airports. It's just, it is obscenely ridiculous. And most people imagine that of the approximately 11 million or more undocumented immigrants in the United States, that virtually all of them are Mexican, when that number is only 6.2 million. And so the breakdown of the countries, for example, China, 268,000, and we can't deport those people because China doesn't cooperate with U.S. deportation. So the brunt of this is racist, both in the rationale for these moves about immigration, racism aimed at Mexicans and other Latin peoples, and racism aimed at Muslims. Will the courts see that? I hope so, but we can't count on it. Here's the heartbreak immigration story of the day. It comes from Sunday's San Francisco Chronicle. A 14-year-old boy who is identified only by his initials, G.E. He escaped from Honduras about a year and a half ago and made his way across our southern border. He is one of over 100,000. I believe the number is 150,000. Yeah, 155,000 children have crossed the southern border in the last 3 years. And GE was granted asylum back in January of this year. But he remains locked up in Yolo County, California, at a county jail that leases space to ICE. And lawyers are feverishly trying to win his release. Not only is he, has he been granted asylum, but he's quite despondent, and he has tried to harm himself or apparently end his life on several occasions. And this is actually something that predates Trump. The machinery of our immigration system doesn't work very well, and a lot of people get hurt in the process. People who thought about liberty when they set their sights on the United States. Now, with all of this going on about Russia, the distractions that Trump generates each time he tweets, there's a page that's circulating on Facebook and other internet sites today that shows some recent bills that have been introduced in Congress. And Sideshow Don is able to run these, run interference for the wrecking crew that is busy dismantling, as Steve Bannon put it, the administrative state. So, H.R. 861 would terminate the Environmental Protection Agency, all of it. H.R. 610, a federal bill for vouchers for public education. H.R. 899 would terminate the Department of Education, presumably after it issued all those vouchers. H.J.R. 69 repealed a rule protecting wildlife. H.R. 370 repealed the Affordable Care Act. That's supposed to surface this week. 354 would defund Planned Parenthood. 785 is a national right to work for less law, which would undermine unions pretty seriously. H.R. 83, mobilizing against sanctuary cities bill. H.R. 147, criminalizing abortion. And H.R. 808, sanctions against Iran. And that's not all. The New York Times today has a whole list of different measures that have been taken. Telecommunications giants will not have to take reasonable measures to ensure that your social security numbers, web browsing history, and other personal information are not stolen or compromised. Wall Street banks will not be punished for not collecting extra money from customers to cover potential losses from certain kinds of high-risk trades. The Social Security Administration will no longer provide data to try to block individuals with disabling mental health issues from buying guns. Oh, the list goes on. The auto industry has presented a list of 17 demands to the Trump administration, including the rescission of an agreement to increase mileage standards. One from the pharmaceutical industry would reverse a new rule that tightens scrutiny over the marketing of prescription drugs for off-label uses. And here's a doozy for you. Lawyers representing the National Mining Association and others have demanded that the Interior Department suspend a new rule changing the way that companies pay royalties for gas, oil, or coal extracted from federal lands. And the Interior Department had been pursuing this for at least 3 years. But with a new boss there, the guy who rode in on horseback, Ryan Zinke, well, the Interior Department changed its tunes. It was supposed to increase revenue by $85 million annually, but hey, those are the friends of the Trump administration and the Republican Party. Over at the FCC, they're undermining net neutrality, and they are looking at ways to allow foreign ownership of telephone companies and broadcast outlets. And Public Citizen warns that there is an effort underway to make it practically impossible to bring class action lawsuits and to also limit medical malpractice lawsuits. Medical malpractice kills as many as 400,000 people a year, and class action lawsuits are being replaced by binding arbitration in many cases. And I just want to mention that recently I signed on with a new investment advisor. The agreement included a mandatory arbitration clause. And I asked them to remove it, not expecting that they would. But in fact, they agreed to. So push the limits if somebody tries to deny you the right to go to court and sue if they screw up with your money. Supreme Court today did a reversal, again, based on a Trump administration move. The Justice Department withdrew its support for the Supreme Court case involving Gavin Grimm. He is the transgender boy from Virginia. And the Supreme Court had accepted his case and had heard oral arguments. But now, because the Trump Justice Department, run by Jeffrey Beauregard Sessions, at least today, has shifted its position, and so the Supreme Court remanded the case back to the lower court and just left the whole issue undecided for now. And while we're distracted by Trump's antics here in this country, he has been bombing Yemen on almost a daily basis, and the rules of engagement for the limited number of U.S. troops who are in Syria today have been changed. And as they prepare to try to push the Islamic State out of Raqqa, we're told that American forces are near the Turkish border, and they're essentially separating the Kurdish fighters, who have been the most reliable behind the incoherent strategies of the United States, in the war against the Islamic State. But because Turkey is so demanding and always premises its involvement in efforts to vanquish the Islamic State behind its own agenda, well, they've gotten the American forces to try to separate the YPG, and I think that puts us in greater risk of deeper involvement, of mission creep. Every day I like to stop for a second and thank the people who support my work with your subscriptions to the Peter B. Collins podcast. People like Jeffrey Lipinski. How many years have you been supporting me, Jeff? I appreciate it. Don Cisney's a monthly subscriber, like Casey Condon and Julie Dupree. I'm grateful to each one of you. And I'd like to invite others to join in and help support my work. Maybe someday I'll be able to make a living doing this. But for now, this is more of a volunteer effort on my part, and subscription dollars help cover the costs of computers and phones and servers and all that stuff. Come on over to peterbcollins.com, click on the menu button, pull it down, click on Become a Subscriber. It takes you to the sign-up page, and I look forward to receiving your support. Sunday's New York Times included a lengthy front-page article about North Korea and about U.S. efforts to find ways to destabilize their missile program, and says that Barack Obama kind of gave up on the missile defense program because the field test showed that the system didn't work, even after we've spent almost $300 billion on Reagan's Star Wars fantasy. Well, what the Times didn't explicitly say is that the U.S. is using some variant on the Stuxnet virus to disable and cause failures at launch of North Korean missiles. And I want to credit Dan Wright at Shadowproof for decoding this for us, and I've linked to his article in the show file for today's podcast. Wednesday is International Women's Day, and women are planning to stage a one-day strike, stage a number of protest rallies here in the Bay Area and across the country, and they are declaring Wednesday as a day without a woman. They're asking women to take a day off work if they can, come to rallies, observe 15 minutes of silence at noon, wear red in solidarity, and I fully support this. We'll see what kind of turnout they get. And appealing to women in this very difficult context, the Republican governor of the Republican governor of Massachusetts, Charlie Baker, who is no saint. He's got problems particularly related to bonds and crony capitalism. But he's taking an important stand here that I commend him for. He has promised that Massachusetts will plug any holes in the budget of Planned Parenthood if Congress moves to block the use of Medicaid funding for treatment at Planned Parenthood. Very glad to see that. We need other Republican governors to step up in a similar way. The Pawnee Nation in Oklahoma is suing over a fracking-related earthquake that did major damage last September. It was a 5.8 quake that did major damage to tribal buildings on their reservation. The twist here is that they are suing in tribal court. I think that's a very novel approach. They have a high level, a high probability, I think, of winning a victory there. And maybe that could be replicated in civilian courts. And finally, on the environmental beat, our friend Steve Horn is a young journalist who does a lot of great investigative and enterprise reporting. And recently at the Smog Blog, he revealed that despite Donald Trump's order when he approved the Keystone XL pipeline and the Dakota Access Pipeline, he ordered that all the steel must be made in America. Well, unfortunately, the Keystone XL pipeline, which is being constructed by a Canadian company, is using steel from a firm that is owned by a Russian oligarch with ties to Trump. His name is Abramovich, and the company is called Evrasna. And Evrasna is largely owned by Russian oligarch Roman Abramovich, a close ally of Putin and a Trump family friend. Now, I'm linking to the article. There's a lot of detail in here. It's pretty fascinating. But what's really disturbing is that over the weekend, MSNBC and its weekend anchor, Joy Reid, lifted Steve Horn and his co-author's work on this story from the Smog Blog, ran it on NBC, tweeted out promotion making it seem that MSNBC had itself made this discovery. There was zero credit or attribution to De Smogblog or Steve Horn. And this goes on far too often a basis, where enterprising bloggers, independent journalists, and others break news, and then it is stolen from them by major media outlets. Thanks for joining me for my News and Comment podcast. It's free every day and available on YouTube. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.